Welcome to the Canada in Geneva podcast, recorded from the permanent mission of Canada to the multilateral organizations in Geneva, Switzerland. This bilingual podcast features conversations in multilateral diplomacy with Canadian and other experts from the multilateral community. Thank you for joining us, and we hope that you enjoy this episode. Bienvenue au balado du Canada à Genève. Enregistré depuis la mission permanente du Canada auprès des organismes multilatéraux à Genève, en Suisse. Ce balado, bilingue, présente des conversations sur la diplomatie multilatérale avec des experts canadiens et d'autres spécialistes de la communauté multilatérale. Merci de nous écouter et nous espérons que vous apprécierez cet épisode. Welcome to a new episode of our Canada in Geneva podcast, in which we try to explore dimensions in multilateralism from a Canadian perspective. My name is Tamara Mawinney. I am with Canada's mission to the UN in Geneva. And today I'm super excited to have as our guest, Shauna Olney, fellow Canadian, and currently wearing multiple multilateral hats that we will have an opportunity to talk about. How are you doing, Shauna?
I'm doing really well. I'm calling in from New York here at the Canadian Mission and really happy to be joining the podcast. Thank you for inviting me.
Terrific. So Canadian Mission to Canadian Mission across the miles. Thank you so much for joining us. I was hoping to start picturing you on the psychiatrist's couch. Tell me about your childhood. But I wanted to ask more particularly, what was your journey from your background and your studies to moving to a multilateral environment? That's an unusual step to take, and it's I'm sure there were not so many people in your own environment that you knew in your schools who also went to work in a multilateral environment. And I would love to hear how that transpired for you.
It's interesting because it was sort of a natural progression, but I would say it really started when I was 8 years old. I remember standing in the middle of my grandparents' living room, and I can remember it absolutely vividly. And I announced to the family that I wanted to be a lawyer. And, you know, they didn't take me terribly seriously. They thought that was really cute coming from an eight-year-old. But I knew. I absolutely had no question about the fact that I was going to do legal training. So, and which I did. So that was the sort of early piece there. And then, of course, I did go to law school. I did my first degree at the University of British Columbia, and then I did a further degree at the University of Oxford. And it was during that time that I also learned a lot about the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, about human rights issues, and really saw the connection between labor rights and human rights. And they're both areas that I've always been interested in. And to see the connection between that was really exciting for me. And to see how practical this area was. I mean, we're all workers or employers for most of our lives. And if you can make a difference in that sphere, you really change society. So it was hugely, hugely motivating for me. And then when I did practice law as well, and I was working on charter cases, actually before I went to Oxford, and absolutely loved that work. It was fantastic. I was very, very fortunate to be able to do the kind of work that I did as a junior associate. And when I went to Oxford, that's when I really learned a lot more about the International Labour Organization. And I saw that this was the place that brought my two passions together, labour and human rights, and looking at it from across the globe, all the different regions, all the different systems, and at the international level. And I was really fascinated by the work of the ILO, and I applied for an internship. So 25 years later, I was still there. So it was a great experience. I enjoyed my time there very much. And I was able to look at labor, employment, human rights issues from various perspectives at the ILO. I think the legal training really, really helped be able to explore different aspects of the ILO's work. So I was really, really fortunate. And yeah, obviously loved it because I stayed there for a very long time.
For 25 years. Well, that's a wonderful sort of explanation of why internships are so important. What an important access point for organizations to be able to open to individuals from around the world and for people to be able to better get to know places in which they might want to work. So looking back on that, obviously hindsight is 2020, and looking back, it can sort of feel like an established path. But for those who are starting out, it doesn't always feel that way. What advice would you give yourself had you as you embarked on that career? And what advice would you give to young women now considering their options in a similar professional area at the intersection of labor and human rights?
I would give myself, and I would give those wanting to go into the UN system now, the same advice. I think although it's 25 years, in a strange way, the UN system probably hasn't changed that much, and for better or for worse. But I think its importance, the things that are important in terms of staff, remain quite similar. So, first of all, I would say, even before you get into the UN system or the multilateral system, be open to all opportunities. You know, you may have a goal, but the road's not always straight, and it doesn't need to be. It probably shouldn't be straight. Learn as much as you can on the road. Take those opportunities that come up. You know, those internships, those short-term contracts. You know, go traveling somewhere really exciting for a year that you've always wanted to go to. You know, and just see what resonates for you. See what really moves you. And you need to work on issues you're passionate about. You know, again, we spend so much of our time in the world of work. We've got to love what we do. We have to feel committed to it. And I think that's perhaps even more important in the UN system, because if you don't believe in what you're doing, you're not going to be able to have an impact. You're not going to be able to support the governments and the other stakeholders in the way you need to. So figure out what you love and make sure you do that. Work hard, learn as much as you can. And if I could just give one more piece of advice, well, actually, I'm going to give two, if I may. One is to ask people to mentor you. And this has been one of the great things in my career. Mm-hmm. I've had formal mentors and I've had informal mentors. Now, sometimes it's actually been the informal ones who have been the most impactful. And I remember having informal mentors when I was a junior official at the ILO, because we didn't have a mentorship program at that time. And just going up to somebody and saying, you know, I really admire you, and would you be willing to meet me for coffee once every couple of weeks, once a month, and just to brainstorm with me, because I'd really like to hear your views. And it's amazing how excited people are when you say, yeah, I admire you and I'd like to listen to you. So don't underestimate that. People, I mean, I think people will react well to that. And when I became a manager for the first time over 15 years ago, one of the first things I did, because it was, you know, it's a big job suddenly going into management and there's a lot to consider, I reached out to one of the managers who I didn't actually know that well and said, you know, similarly, I said, would you be my mentor? And again, he was thrilled. So from my very first job to, you know, all through my various positions in the ILO, I've sought out mentors. And then the very last thing is learn languages and learn them early. It's a lot easier when you're younger. They're really the key to understanding many countries, and they're really the key to the culture, which is so important when you're engaging with different representatives. And I think it just opens up, you know, whole new worlds. So really, languages are absolutely key. And I can't emphasize that strong enough. And in the UN, it's very, very important wherever you're working.
Et quelle belle passerelle que cela fait, parce qu'on aime faire ce balado diffusion en deux langues, les deux langues officielles du Canada. Mais merci beaucoup pour de souligner l'importance du mentorat, parce que je peux aussi confirmer que ça m'est arrivé maintenant. J'ai eu le privilège d'être mentor. Et il n'y a rien de plus satisfaisant et de stimulant de pouvoir jouer ce rôle. Donc, dans les deux sens, c'est une très belle expérience et très importante. Donc, c'est merveilleux de savoir à quel point ça peut aider dans les carrières. Et d'autant plus dans ce contexte que tu décris, c'est l'importance de tout ce qui est très informel maintenant et de durée déterminée. C'est souvent par ces portes-là que les carrières démarrent maintenant. Il y a beaucoup moins de parcours prédéfinis. Et donc, là aussi, le rôle du mentorat est tellement important. Et donc, on peut ensuite parler de ta carrière, ta longue carrière, près de 25 ans, si je ne me trompe, au sein de l'Organisation internationale du travail. Et ce serait intéressant d'entendre pour toi quels sont les deux ou trois, si on peut se limiter à deux ou trois moments phares? Quelles ont été les belles expériences dont tu te rappelles maintenant que tu as pris ta retraite depuis l'OIT, pour ne pas dévoiler des grands secrets?
Merci bien. Oui, c'est très difficile de se limiter à deux ou trois, mais je vais faire mon mieux. Tout au long de ma carrière à l'OIT, j'ai eu l'occasion de contribuer au développement d'une vision stratégique et des conseils techniques sur un éventail de lois et de politiques nationales et internationales. Et je me suis déplacée dans plusieurs pays pour travailler directement avec les gouvernements sur la refonte du droit du travail, l'examen et la révision des lois, et pour conseiller les gouvernements et les autres parties prenantes sur une gamme de politiques et de normes internationales. Et comme j'avais dit, je suis actuellement à New York maintenant, et ça c'est pour les élections de la Commission de la fonction publique internationale. Et hier soir, j'ai assisté à une réception et j'ai rencontré des représentants gouvernementaux du pays où j'avais travaillé sur leurs lois et politiques. Et ça c'était très intéressant pour moi. On peut vraiment discuter. Ouais, tout.
C'est remarquable. Quelle coïncidence.
Tout à fait. Et de voir l'incidence que le travail de l'OIT peut avoir très concrètement sur la vie des travailleurs et travailleuses et les employeurs. Pour moi, c'était super. C'était très important d'avoir cet impact. Et par un exemple, quand j'ai travaillé sur un projet pour harmoniser les lois de travail aux Caraïbes anglophones, CARICOM, nous avons effectué des visites sur le terrain. Et quand je suis allée dans une usine pour le traitement de noix de muscade, j'ai vu les femmes assises par terre effectuant un travail très, très difficile. Et par contre, les hommes, qui étaient les superviseurs, se tenaient debout autour d'elles, avec les écouteurs, écoutant le cricket. Et cette image m'a profondément touchée. Et je me souviens d'avoir fait la réflexion que si les lois qui étaient proposées, y compris pour l'égalité salariale, la sécurité et la santé au travail, étaient mises en œuvre, quelle différence cela ferait dans la vie de ces femmes? Mais ma grande fierté, c'est un rôle de chef de file dans la conception et la mise en œuvre de l'initiative du centenaire des femmes au travail de l'OIT.
Mm-hmm. Oui.
Il a commencé avec des recherches et des données innovantes. Et premièrement, nous avons travaillé avec Gallup pour faire un sondage global pour mieux comprendre ce que les femmes voulaient dans le monde du travail. Et quels sont les obstacles? Et les résultats étaient très intéressants. Dans toutes les régions, les femmes veulent occuper des emplois rémunérés. Et ça, c'était clair. Mais elles ne sont pas représentées sur le marché du travail au même niveau que leurs aspirations. Et dans chaque région et chaque pays, l'un des principaux obstacles est lié aux activités de soins non rémunérés. Difficulté à réconcilier travail et famille, absence de garderie et de soins aux personnes âgées. En conséquence, nous avons examiné de près l'économie des soins à autrui. Et encore, avec les résultats très, très intéressants, les femmes, et ça c'était avant la crise de la COVID-19, réalisaient plus de trois quarts de l'ensemble de soins à autrui. 600 millions de femmes par rapport à 40 millions d'hommes sont absents du marché du travail à cause des activités de soins non rémunérés. Et la pandémie de la COVID-19 a fait apparaître encore plus les inégalités entre hommes et femmes dans ce domaine, entre autres.
It's wonderful to hear you speak about that because it's at that point that I first met you. In fact, my recollection of my first meeting with you at the ILO was you emerging from your office carrying very proudly the first copy of the report on care work and the preliminary work you'd done on that. And I remember thinking how groundbreaking that was and what a remarkable experience. I think for so many people, when one uses the word multilateral, it immediately conjures up very abstract, perhaps very boring activities. But it's so refreshing to hear from you how very concrete and very real multilateral norm setting, standard setting work on the ground in the field that these organizations actually carry out. I'm sure it was not always easy because so much of the work that you undertook, particularly in your last post at the ILO on gender equality, conditions of work, you were at the forefront in leading some significant changes and achievements. It's not always easy, though. How do you look back on that time? How difficult was it to achieve some of those concrete markers of progress, moving the yardsticks?
We can look at it from two different perspectives, and it certainly is never easy. I don't think anybody goes into the area of gender equality and non-discrimination because it's easy or simple. There are lots of obstacles, I think, wherever you are, but one needs to have that commitment to move forward and just, not be blocked. I remember before we did the Gallup work, we were trying to get the director general to sign off on some work on gender equality, and he kept knocking us back. And we would come out of the meetings feeling very depressed and feeling like,
Like you were almost there and so close to reaching the target.
exactly. But he kept challenging us. And, so we let ourselves be unhappy for about 24 hours. And then we had to rise to the challenge. Like, okay, well, what is he looking for? How can we do something really innovative? And that's actually what pushed us to propose the Gallup work. And really, the Gallup work helped to change the narrative about women in the world of work, because no longer could people say to us,
To give you real data.
And when we would hear, as we often did, you don't understand, women in our country don't really want to work in paid jobs, we could actually show them the hard data and say, yeah, actually, in your country, the majority of women do want to work in paid jobs. Now let's see what's holding them back, and let's see what we can do from a policy perspective to move that forward. So it had very, very practical applications. And I think that was great. I think it was good that we were pushed. It was good that, sometimes we have to think in a different direction. And, certainly when we look at, we did the Gallup work, we did the care work and care jobs work. We did the work on equal pay for mm-hmm. work of equal value. And we also set up the work on equal pay, including the Equal Pay International Coalition, EPIC. And again, all these things take time. They take momentum. They take commitment. And now, you know, EPIC is up and running. Canada is a great leader in EPIC, as well as a number of other countries, and really trying to move the needle on equal pay.
Right, right.
The other area that we worked on in the context of the Women at Work initiative was violence and harassment. So again, we saw in the Gallup poll, we saw that care work was really the main issue everywhere, but we also saw unequal pay was an issue, and we saw that issues around discrimination and abuse were issues. So mm-hmm. we pulled up all those three as priorities, and we again did some in-depth work on violence and harassment, and
yes.
that ended up being transformed into the preparatory work leading to the adoption of the Convention and Recommendation on Violence and Harassment. So mm-hmm. it's a wonderful convention and recommendation, very practical. We now have a clear and common framework for addressing and preventing violence and harassment in the world of work.
A great landmark.
And, I mean, that came to pass because of an incredible commitment from the office, but importantly, from the constituents. So I think what's really exciting about this is, you know, it wasn't something that was generated by the movement, the global movement and the global outcry against sexual harassment with the hashtag MeToo movement and others. It actually came before that. The decision to put it on the agenda came before that. But then those global movements and just the visibility across the globe on these issues, I think, created a momentum that really brought us to 2019 and the adoption of really strong instruments on these issues.
Right.
So we had the commitment and the research within the office, and we also had the commitment from the constituents, which is absolutely essential. And, you know, you bring those together with a global movement mm-hmm. and, you know, it just all came together very, very powerful. Absolutely. So if we look at the internal part of trying to make progress on gender equality within the ILO, you know, that's a very different dynamic, but similar issues are in play. You know, we had, when I first started as the chief of the Gender Equality and Diversity Branch, there was already in the works an external review of the gender action plans, and we'd had gender action plans in the ILO since 1999, but there were areas where things were stalled. So the evaluation that we had, this analysis, was really very clear. It brought out those weak areas, and we didn't hide them. I mean, what we did was when we did a paper for the governing body outlining all the issues, we brought up those weak points and we made them very transparent. And the governing body was incredibly supportive. So they came forward, and I think this was in 2015, and said, the ILO, we have to be a model, all of us, constituents and the office. And, you know, so let's really look at these areas where we're weak and let's improve and let's really get an action plan that will improve these. The other issue that came out, and it came out in the evaluation, it came out in the discussion with the governing body, was accountability. Now, this is always the issue with gender. If you're talking about gender equality, it's quite easy to abdicate responsibility, particularly if there's a unit that has gender in its name. Like, well, they deal with gender, we deal with the other stuff. And, you know, it's almost to the point, well, you know, they'll deal with the women, although gender is much more than that, and we'll deal with the men. It's, hello, that
yes.
can't work.
Yeah.
So, but I think a lot of it is a lack of understanding about gender equality issues. It's not that people are trying to be difficult or don't want to incorporate the gender issues. A lot of it is about not knowing how. So once you get that accountability and you create the knowledge base as well, you know, because you as a unit that's accountable, as the manager that's accountable, you also have to make sure your staff is equipped. And so there was a lot of work in that area. And instead of always pointing to, you know, the gender equality and diversity branch, units and departments were taking on this work, and we were seeing a real sea change in the ILO. So it came from within and it came from without, but it really helped to make a significant change.
Exactly. Yes.
And I think you need the pressure from all sides, quite frankly.
Yes. It all has to come together. And perhaps you were able to take advantage of the 100-year anniversary, creates a little extra focus to give that little push. But it's you. What you describe there is a voyage for the ILO to becoming a real thought leader on gender, which is exactly what one would hope and expect for an organization of its kind and its unique status. So it's an incredible set of achievements that you were able to lead and help others achieve as well. So looking ahead, you've now retired from your position at the ILO, and you are now, we're so proud to say, Canada's candidate for the International Civil Service Commission, and would love to hear about your objectives for this new challenge ahead.
Thanks so much. And first of all, just to say how honored I was when I was asked to be Canada's candidate, and you might know something about that, Tamara.
Yes, just a happy memory. Yes, absolutely.
No, I was leaving the ILO early, taking early retirement, but certainly wasn't ready to stop contributing to the UN system. And, you know, I'm really excited now to have this possibility with the International Civil Service Commission. We'll see what happens with the elections, but it's been very exciting, and working with a wonderful Canadian team from Ottawa, from Geneva, from New York. It's it really couldn't be, I couldn't be better.
It's a multilateral endeavor.
Absolutely. The 15-member commission has a key role to play in the UN system, since it regulates terms and conditions of employment of UN staff in over 600 duty stations, and it makes a wide range of recommendations on human resources policies. So these are areas that I've worked on in the ILO for many, many years. And it would be, I think, a useful way for me to continue to contribute. And, you know, we need a strong UN now. As the world continues to address and recovers from COVID-19 and faces, no doubt, many other challenges ahead. And it's been interesting during the discussions with member states here in New York. A lot of the issues that come up are issues that I've dealt with in my career, including the equality and non-discrimination issues, violence and harassment. And, you know, these are areas where the ICSC can make recommendations, and I could certainly contribute an expertise in those areas. You know, when we go back to the Violence and Harassment Convention, Convention 190, it offers a really strong framework for addressing violence and harassment in the world of work. And it's something that could be integrated much more across the UN system as well, in terms of the UN's own policies and practices. So these are areas where I'd certainly love to contribute if that's a possibility. And of course, the dialogue component, I mean, that at the core of the work of the ILO is social dialogue. And making sure you consult, you discuss, that decisions are made hearing all the different views and all the different voices, and to the extent possible, trying to bring those together. And that was certainly a big part of our work moving forward in any capacity. It's not the simplest way to do things. It's not the easiest. It's not the quickest. But I think you come up with the best results, and also results that are well accepted, because people have been heard. process matters. And that's certainly something I think would be important for the ICSC. It is important for the ICSC. And it's the only way that it can work really effectively. And that's, again, an experience that I would happily bring to the ICSC.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think it's so clear. No one ever accused multilateralism of being easy. It's definitely a slow process of building blocks to achieve those great aha moments, as we call them, when the momentum and the coalitions come together to allow you to achieve progress. But all the things that you've mentioned today, mentorship, working multilaterally, working in several languages, all those things, it seems to me, are so important when we look to the International Civil Service Commission, which is a real guardian and gatekeeper of all the individuals who make up the staff force, the workforce of the UN around the world. And so important to ensure that we have the greatest possible diversity across that workforce, but also that they work in the best possible conditions, be they working in Geneva, in New York, in Nairobi, or at duty stations around the world. So we're certainly very excited about the election next week. And I think it's going to be a really exciting and challenging time. Any other last thoughts as we wind up?
Well, we can't have a strong UN system without skilled and motivated staff. So I absolutely agree with what you're saying. And just a last point, I believe deeply in the UN system and ensuring a meaningful common system. And I hope I'll be able to continue to contribute in that context. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you. They'll be so lucky to have you, and so important to hear those voices in support of multilateralism, and so important to hear those Canadian voices in support. So best of luck, and we look forward to catching up in the future.
Thank you so much.